Heather Bale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Mary Kay Bellinger, Executive Director of Operations, and Andrea DeMore, Executive Director of Academics for the Beacon Academy of Nevada, along with Tam Shear, CEO of Opportunity 180. Beacon Academy is expanding its impact by doubling the enrollment capacity of its Westside campus with support from a Nevada Facilities Fund loan. Thank you all so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
So, Tam, what exactly is Opportunity 180?
Yeah, so Opportunity 180 is a nonprofit that works towards a North Star where every kid graduates high school, college, and career ready, prepared to live the life that they dream. And so one of the ways we do that is ensuring that there is more innovative schools that meet the needs of our students, and hence the Nevada Facility Fund and Beacon Academy's partnership.
Nice. Okay. And when was Opportunity 180 founded?
It was founded in 2016, and our new strategic framework went into place in 2020.
And Andrea, what's Beacon Academy?
Beacon Academy is a public charter alternative education high school. And so we only enroll students who are the most at risk of not graduating from high school. And that is defined by being severely credit deficient, holding an IEP, so special education students, having been adjudicated under court supervision, suspended, or expelled.
Okay. Mary Kay, tell us more about Beacon Academy's expansion.
Well, with the recent expansion, we were able to purchase our West Campus property, which expanded into two buildings now. So we have doubled our footprint on the West Campus so that we can have additional classrooms and offices in order to serve that many more students.
Where exactly is Beacon Academy located?
Our West Campus is located at 7360 West Flamingo, and our East Campus is at 1800 East Sahara.
And so this recent expansion is for the Flamingo location?
That is correct. We bought the property that we had been currently leasing since 2012, which contained two buildings of similar footprint, but we only leased one building. So with the purchase of the property, now we have both buildings.
That's great. Tam, can you tell us more about the Nevada Facilities Fund?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's exciting. It's the first of its kind public-private partnership and really addresses a critical issue for high-performing public charter schools. So while charter schools are free, public, and open to all and receive public funding, they have to use their per pupil funding on their facilities, which really limits the amount of money that can go into classrooms. And so the fund itself infuses $100 million of new investments in Nevada, including $80 million from the Equitable Facility Fund's national funders and investors, $15 million from the Nevada State Infrastructure Bank, and $5 million in privately raised philanthropy. So in our first year, we've closed three loans to high-performing public charter schools for a total investment of over $28 million. That will impact over 2,200 students. And of the students that will impact, 93% identify as kids of color, students of color, 95% qualify for free and reduced lunch, and almost 30% of those students are English learners.
And what exactly does one of these high-performing charter schools need to do in order to qualify for the Nevada Facilities Fund?
Yeah, good question. So they have to be a nonprofit and they have to serve a student population that is considered at risk. They also have to show strong financial and academic performance indicators to ensure that they are high quality. And then there's a diligence process that they go through with the Equitable Facility Fund itself to ensure that they are a good investment. But the biggest thing is that they serve a student population that would be considered at risk and that they have strong financial and academic indicators.
Okay. Andrea, where could local families find out more about Beacon Academy and how the programming works there?
We have all of our information on our website, banv.org. There's information about criteria to enroll, as well as our locations, and there's actually an application on our website as well.
And Tim, where can listeners find out more information about Opportunity 180 and all the work that you do in the state?
Yeah, you can go to our website. It's a great resource, opportunity180.org. And then there'll be a link for the facilities funds, as well as we have a data portal if you want to get access on data for all the schools, that very easy to see the academic outcomes of all the schools. And BoardWatch, where we'll watch every public board meeting, state, Clark County, Washoe, and the State Public Charter School Authority. You can get recaps of those, as well as additional resources for community members interested in getting involved, educators interested in expanding their opportunities, and schools looking to receive some thought partnership, investment, or strategic support.
Awesome. Okay, so once again, those websites are opportunity180.org is the main website for Opportunity 180. That will let you know more about what they do in the state, including the Nevada Facilities Fund that they implement and run for these high-performing charter schools, the nonprofit at-risk schools that have access to the fund if they qualify for it. So opportunity180.org. And if you'd like to find out more about Beacon Academy, BANV.org is the website for that. Beacon Academy of Nevada, BANV.org. And you can find out more about the programming that they have for high school students who are at risk of not graduating. So BANV.org. And they do have the two locations, West Flamingo and East Sahara. And we've been speaking today with Mary Kay Bellinger, Executive Director of Operations at Beacon Academy, and Andrea DeMore, Executive Director of Academics for Beacon Academy, as well as Tam Shear, CEO of Opportunity 180, who again oversees the Nevada Facilities Fund loans. And I really appreciate you all being here. This is great news that you're able to serve so many new students with the help of this loan and being able to expand the campus. And just the amazing work that you do for the community, not only offering charter school education as a choice for the students who are falling through the cracks, but also Tam with Opportunity 180, all the work that you do in the state is just fantastic. So thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Heather.
All right, thanks, Heather.
School absences are often due to the absence of necessary resources. But when Communities in Schools is present, students are connected to the support they need to show up ready to learn. Visit communitiesinschools.org. Being present matters.
This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Brendan Martin, Research Director at the National Council of State Boards of Nursing, or NCSBN. The organization has comprehensive new research that offers critical insight into how the nursing profession is doing since the COVID-19 pandemic and what challenges remain. Brendan, thank you so much for being here today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, what is the National Council of State Boards of Nursing?
So, the National Council of State Boards of Nursing is really like the national organization which provides support resources to all the individual state boards of nursing in every jurisdiction around the United States. So we assist both in terms of, from my perspective, in providing research to really help nursing regulators at the state level implement evidence-based policy.
Okay. So how has the situation changed for the U.S. nursing workforce since the COVID-19 pandemic?
So overall, in our report, we found evidence of a workforce recovery following the emergency phase of the COVID-19 pandemic. Our analysis specifically pinpointed that this was likely driven by a rebound among older, more experienced nurses who re-entered the profession following 2022. That being said, we also noted that many of the structural factors that nurses have long identified as really the primary reasons for departing the workforce remain in 2024.
Okay, and what are some of those issues that caused them to have problems during the pandemic and that still remain?
Yeah, so specifically, when we talk about kind of the structural issues, what we're referring to is issues of short staffing and accompanying high workloads with that. Layered on top of that, something that was obviously kind of on all the headlines during the COVID-19 pandemic are elevated rates of burnout and stress that really kind of result from those structural factors. So we have seen those rates moderate somewhat in the 2024 survey cycle, but at the same time, they remain elevated, certainly compared to pre-pandemic trends.
Okay, so how many nurses have left the workforce since 2022?
So approximately 138,000 nurses exited the workforce since the emergency phase of the COVID-19 pandemic. And the reasons that they identified for kind of leaving the profession were specifically short staffing, high workloads, elevated burnout and stress. We also saw instances of workplace violence and bullying being an issue, inadequate salary. So there's a multitude of factors, but I would say that the biggest ones are short staffing, high workload, and burnout.
Okay. And if they keep leaving, obviously that's not going to help the situation of short staffing. So besides the older nurses coming back to the workforce, what do you foresee correcting that?
Yeah, I think we need to be, you know, 2025, we here at NCSBN really feel as though the research suggests that this is kind of a critical inflection point. We do see evidence of early momentum for workforce recovery, but it's beholden on leaders across many different sectors. So obviously our lens is nursing regulation, but we also think educators have a role to play. Practice, private employers, we think policymakers have a role to play. This is kind of one of those moments in time when it's an all hands on deck approach that is really necessary to implement policies to address some of these longstanding structural issues. In our survey, 25 to 35%, I mean, these are huge proportions of nurses identified short staffing and high workloads as drivers of their intent to leave. 40% of nurses said that they were dealing with acute levels of burnout. And by acute, we mean weekly, if not daily. So they're really important issues. And I think we need to be very intentional with the policy to make sure that we set this up for sustainable workforce planning.
Okay, what kinds of policies would need to be in place in order for that to happen?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, as we think about workforce planning, you know, first and foremost, we think about new career entrants, training nurses, making sure that they feel prepared to enter the workplace. But when we think about some of our survey results, it's really about retention of current nurses. So some of the policies or strategies that you could put in place are robust transition to practice policies and structures. In addition to that, you know, the more peer-to-peer mentoring, making sure that the context in which the nurse is trying to practice is safe, that they feel as though that they're well supported and there are sufficient resources to practice to the top of their education and license. I think all of these factors, there's no one silver bullet in all of this, because this is decades really of research telling us that these structural issues have really plagued the nursing workforce. So I think it's folks from across a full array of sectors that really need to be brought together to inform on the policies.
Okay. Now, you've mentioned how many nurses have left the workforce. How many more of them have not yet left the workforce, but intend to leave within the next few years?
Yeah. So 40% of the respondents to our survey indicated an intent to either leave the profession or retire, with just over half of that sample basically indicating planned retirement. So that's one of the interesting findings from our survey. It's really the dual results of the older, more experienced nurses coming back into the workforce in the past 2-year cycle, coupled with the fact that they're also reporting elevated intent to retire in kind of the short to intermediate term. So it gives us a little bit of pause when we think about how sustainable is the bounce that we documented in 2024. And that's why it's imperative that policy is put in place now to really kind of head off any shortage in the future.
Yeah, for sure. Now, it seems like it might be something that could snowball out of control if those policies weren't put in place. What are some of the implications that this study would have for the healthcare system overall and for patients as well?
Yeah, I think that that's an absolutely great question. So again, we see that early momentum, but to not only maintain current healthcare standards, but also to keep up with where projected healthcare demand is going, right? In the next few decades, I think that there's a great deal of evidence and research to suggest that essentially, you know, healthcare demand is going to outstrip supply. So to make sure that we don't get into that position, I think we need to make sure that we're addressing these structural issues of high workloads, of burnout, and making sure that essentially nurses feel both well supported in their workplace, but also that they feel safe in their workplace. And so those types of policies, if put in place, could potentially head off some of those, you know, shortage projections that we see. But absent those, you are correct. You know, we'll inevitably be in that situation where, you know, retention becomes ever harder.
Yeah, for sure. All right. This is obviously a very important issue. So where can listeners go if they'd like to learn more about it?
Yeah, we feel as though these findings are so critical that every cycle that we run this survey, we make the full results of the report freely available to anyone who wants to use the findings to kind of inform their decision making or their debate. So I would encourage your listeners to go to ncsbn.org/workforce. There, they'll be able to review kind of the high level findings of the survey. And then they'll also find some embedded links where they can navigate directly to the full report and download it.
All right, fantastic. So once again, that website is ncsbn.org/workforce. NCSBN stands for National Council of State Boards of Nursing. So ncsbn.org/workforce. You can access the full results of the report that we've been talking about today on the state of nursing in the U.S. since the COVID pandemic, the challenges that remain, and what needs to be done. So ncsbn.org/workforce. And we've been speaking today with Brendan Martin, Research Director at the National Council of State Boards of Nursing. And Brendan, I really appreciate you being here and letting us know more about this issue. It obviously affects pretty much all of us. So I really appreciate you being here and sharing with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Over the years, you've brought opioids into your home. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But holding on to opioids puts your family at risk. Learn more at www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Edgerly, Senior Director of Community Programs and Services at the Alzheimer's Association. The organization's latest Alzheimer's Disease Facts and Figures report is a comprehensive compilation of national statistics and information on Alzheimer's and related dementias, and it shows that Americans want earlier detection of the disease. Dr. Edgerly, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Heather.
So what is the Alzheimer's Association?
The Alzheimer's Association is the largest nationwide organization focused on creating a world without Alzheimer's and all other dementias. So we focus on advancing research, we focus on advancing care and support, and we're a major player around advocacy and public policy. Ultimately, we want to make life better for those living with Alzheimer's and all other types of dementias, but we also want to change the future and change the trajectory of what we see as a growing trend in more and more people developing Alzheimer's and other types of dementias as well.
Yeah. What did the new Alzheimer's Association Facts and Figures report uncover?
So what we showed is a significant trend towards growth in the number of people living with Alzheimer's this year. For the first time ever, we are now at over 7 million Americans living with Alzheimer's. We grew by about 300,000 in the last year, so we're now at 7.2 million people living with Alzheimer's. And right alongside them now are 12 million caregivers. These would be friends and family who support them. As we see those numbers grow, so too do we see the cost growing. So an increase of $24 billion in the last year.
Wow. What do you attribute this growth to?
Well, there's multiple factors. One of the factors, of course, is that we're living longer and we're also surviving things that used to cause us to die either sooner or in greater numbers. So as we survive things like heart disease and cancer, we live longer and we develop Alzheimer's in greater numbers. Also, we see changes in rates of diagnosis. We're getting a little better, although we could certainly improve more around diagnosis. And then lastly, we're noting increases in doctors putting Alzheimer's on a death certificate. And so all of those things are changing the numbers a little bit here. But ultimately, the biggest factor is that we're living longer.
Yeah, definitely. What's happening in Nevada specifically?
So in Nevada, we have about 55,000 people living with Alzheimer's disease, and there are 87,000 caregivers providing support to them on a daily basis.
Okay. What did your report tell you about the attitudes on Alzheimer's diagnosis and treatment?
What we heard loud and clear in this report is that Americans want early access to Alzheimer's testing. essentially what people are looking for, and this was 90% of those we surveyed indicated that they would like a simple test, like a blood test. And they would take a test because they would want to find out early if they had Alzheimer's, ideally even before the symptoms occur or while the symptoms are very mild.
So what's the current testing protocol for Alzheimer's?
The testing is a much longer, more involved process than a blood test today. What happens now is people will go into their doctor and talk about concerns. They'll do a medical history. They may do some memory testing or other types of cognitive testing. And then they need to undergo some scans like a brain scan, or in some cases, they may even have a spinal tap to determine if it's Alzheimer's. And ultimately, what we see is this can take a lot of time, and there can be a lot of uncertainty about what we're dealing with. That's why something like a blood test, while it doesn't work all on its own, would really help in speeding up the process and also helping people feel more confident in their diagnosis.
Interesting. Okay. What types of Alzheimer's treatments are Americans asking for?
So Americans are looking for treatments that slow the progression of the disease, or ideally even show improvement. So we heard that 92% of Americans surveyed would like access to those kinds of treatments, but they're also interested in treatments that could help with the symptoms. It may not slow the progression, but it might boost functioning. That was over 90% of people looking for that. And also, people were interested in having education and support around lifestyle changes. So what can I do to maybe improve my diet and exercise or other habits in order to maintain or maybe even improve my brain health, even while I'm living with Alzheimer's?
Yeah, for sure. What do Americans think about the future of Alzheimer's?
We heard loud and clear that Americans are optimistic about the future. They believe that in the next decade, we're going to have new types of treatments and approaches to slow and maybe even prevent Alzheimer's. And we think their optimism is warranted. You know, there are 140 different therapies in the pipeline. We don't know how many will come to the final finish line, but that's promising for the future.
So overall, what would you say is the biggest takeaway from this new Alzheimer's Association Facts and Figures report?
So what we saw is a major shift in that people's attitudes towards finding out whether they have Alzheimer's and being able to proactively address those concerns is a shift from what we've seen in the past. Often people have avoided the subject or avoided the idea of getting tested. And this suggests to us that it's a new day, that people are open to getting a test, especially if it's easy, and that they'd like to take steps to improve their health as early as possible.
That's great. So where can people go to find out more information about Alzheimer's disease or the current data from your latest report?
So our website's a great place to go at alz.org/facts or alz.org in general. Lots of wonderful information to learn more about Alzheimer's and any other type of dementia.
Great. Okay. So once again, that website is alz.org is the main website for Alzheimer's Association, alz.org/facts. If you'd like to find out more about the facts around Alzheimer's, the latest data, alz.org is easy to remember, very simple, great URL. And we've been speaking today with Dr. Elizabeth Edgerly, Senior Director of Community Programs and Services at the Alzheimer's Association. And Dr. Edgerly, I really appreciate you being here, letting us know, first of all, the latest data on what Americans think about Alzheimer's, its outlook, and what they want in terms of diagnosis and in terms of treatment access. And also, of course, Alzheimer's being, as you mentioned, an increasing disease, having the information there available that maybe people don't know about the Alzheimer's Association and the resources you have there. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Heather. Take care.
My early Alzheimer's diagnosis was hard to take,
but it gave my mom and me more time to plan together.
Talk to your family about seeing a doctor. Go to alz.org/time to talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Elizabeth Baker, Director of Research Policy at the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, or PCRM. The FDA recently announced plans to stop animal testing, and a new survey found that 86% of Americans agreed animal experimentation should be phased out in favor of more modern research methods. Elizabeth, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, what is the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine?
Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine is a nonprofit. We're based in Washington, D.C., and we have been around since 1985. We've been working for more effective and ethical and humane research, testing, and advanced education. And we also have a medical center, and we work to advance good nutrition as well.
Awesome. Okay. So tell us about the FDA's recent decision on animal testing.
Well, it has been an absolutely historic month for those of us that are working to replace the use of animals in research and testing. The Food and Drug Administration, they are responsible for regulating drug testing. They have announced a goal and a plan to replace animal testing for drugs. And this is such a big deal because it recognizes the scientific and the ethical issues with animal testing, the many benefits of changing to support innovative, predictive, and human-based science. And then just after the FDA made its announcement, our National Institutes of Health, which is the largest funder of medical research in the world, also announced a plan to move away from animal use. So it's just really a fantastic time to be working in this space and to do better science that can really help advance human health and our understanding of disease, as well as ensure that patients have access to safer and more effective medications.
Do you think the FDA's announcement influenced the National Institutes of Health?
I think that support for this has been building for so long. You mentioned that the public, 86% of people, would love to see animal testing phased out. That's been building for a long time. There's also congressional support for this. We've seen this as a nonpartisan issue that has built up in recent years. There's been great support from Congress, from both sides of the aisle, reaching out to the agency, making requests that both of these agencies move away from animal use. Also legislation to advance the non-animal approaches and some funding as well to help reduce animal use. So that has happened. There's been some really great recommendations that have come from science advisory boards to the National Institutes of Health and to the Food and Drug Administration. And so this has really been building, but we did need strong leadership from the agencies, and we have that. So I don't know that the FDA necessarily influenced the NIH. I don't know that for sure, but I do think that, you know, these weren't just general goals. These are thought out plans that are really comprehensive. So I think the National Institutes of Health leaders have been thinking about this and working toward it internally for a while, as well as the Food and Drug Administration.
Okay. Well, either way, it's amazing, obviously.
Yes.
What are some of these modern techniques that can replace animal testing?
So when we talk about the modern techniques, so some people will call them human-based, human-specific, human-relevant, human-centered. Really, the big thing to understand is that these are more relevant for humans because they're utilizing human information. So human cells and tissues and data, and they're more relevant because it's utilizing the same biology, and it helps us to avoid the translational issues that come with experimenting on one species and hoping that it's going to translate to another. So some of the examples, I usually think of these non-clinical, meaning that these happen before you move into humans, as either advanced lab-based, or the term is in vitro techniques, and then advanced, very sophisticated computer-based modeling. A lab technique, one of them is organ chips. There's also a lot of names for these. You might hear organs on chips, organ chips, tissue chips, microphysiological systems. It all really means the same thing. They are these very impressive platforms that are engineered to mimic the structure and the function of human organs. And they actually use human cells that are seeded into these platforms. So they can be used, for example, to test for toxicity in liver cells. And they are more predictive because they're utilizing that human information. Then you also have the computer-based models. These are really fantastic because they allow scientists to use these complex biological systems, essentially, are predicted utilizing machine learning and even AI. So you can predict toxicity using those. They can analyze drug structures and link to known clinical outcomes. There's just so much that can be done between these advanced in vitro and the computational approaches. Some of them will be just really one-to-one replacements. For example, if scientists are trying to understand what will happen when a product is applied on the skin, well, there are just really good replacement models that use human cells to regrow human skin in a lab. So those can just be replaced kind of one-to-one. But then there are other things that maybe are a little bit more complex that will be a combination of the lab-based and the computer-based models.
Okay, so we're talking computers, AI, and pieces of humans, but it's not referring to clinical trials when they say human-based testing.
Well, clinical trials are, I think, actually quite important. And this depends on kind of what you're looking at. But for drug testing, of course, clinical trials are a very important part of understanding the safety and efficacy of a new drug. So we are, though, what we're talking about with the non-clinical phase, and the animal testing really happens largely before the human trials. So those are happening anyway. So it's really about ensuring that we switch out the animal-based tests that are not predictive for humans with these more predictive models so that we can make better decisions about what goes into humans, so we can protect those humans better who are in the clinical trials. But we also talked about the National Institutes of Health and its announcement. There are some things that are being done in animals that really could just be stopped altogether, like animal experiments to look at effects of alcohol that we already know in humans. But there are other uses of animals where you could use clinical trials. One example of that is human nutrition. People are always shocked to find out animals are used really painful, terrible ways in an attempt to study human nutrition when we could just use clinical trials. And so, yes, clinical trials are going to be key to this. They're important, but there's, you know, only one piece of it. And certainly when we're talking about looking into safety or toxicity, we want to make sure that we're utilizing these advanced computational and lab-based methods to protect people and to make better decisions about what moves into humans.
Wow. All right. So where can people go for more information about this news on animal testing or the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine in general?
So the FDA has a press release that links to its plan, which is quite comprehensive, for how it will phase out animal testing for drugs. The National Institutes of Health also has a press release where they talk about their initiative. And then we have our own, you know, we've been working toward these successes for many years, both for the National Institutes of Health and the Food and Drug Administration. So, of course, we have our own write-ups on what's going on and digging into some of the details from our perspective. And you can find that at PCRM.org. So Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, PCRM.org.
All right. Fantastic. So once again, PCRM.org is the website for Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. pcrm.org. You can find out the news there as well as links and a lot of background information, or you can go straight to the FDA or the NIH and read their press releases on animal testing as well. And all of that information is freely available right now. So for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, the website is pcrm.org. And we've been speaking today with Elizabeth Baker, Director of Research Policy at the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And Elizabeth, I really appreciate you being here, letting us know more about this issue. You know, as we mentioned, the vast majority of Americans would like animal experimentation to end now that we've got two major government organizations announcing their intention to end it. It's really modern forward movement and great news for the animals. So thank you so much for sharing today.
You're so welcome. Thanks for doing the story.
We are the National Park Foundation, and together with your support, we are building a bold future where national parks are vibrant, protected, and welcoming. Learn more at nationalparks.org/foundation.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Carrie Irons, VP of Brand Marketing at Pilot. A new survey from the company reveals what Americans are planning for their summer adventures and road trips. Carrie, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So what does your survey reveal about summer travel for this year?
Yeah, well, we talked to a lot of drivers this summer, and what we're finding out is that people are wanting and craving flexibility and spontaneity. So they're doing what's called these pop-up escapes. So we're looking at 90% of people that we talked to that are interested in taking these getaways this summer, want to get out. They do these pop-up escapes for, you know, 1 to 3 days, and they're typically within 200 miles of their home. So it's all about figuring out how to get away with your friends and family during a super busy time over the summer and making moments that matter.
Yeah, I can get on board with that. But why do you think people are planning more weekend getaways in these shorter pop-up trips than in past years?
Yeah, great question. So a lot of it has to do with how do we can step away in our busy lives. I think it's all about de-stressing. It's finding those moments with your family and friends on the road. And a lot of it has to do with budget. So when you're planning a 1 to 3 day trip, it's usually what we find is a sweet spot's around $500. So that's a big part of this. But it's also about getting in your car and, you know, you're driving down the road, and we're hearing from over 50% of people that want to find these hidden gems around the corner. And so that's a big part of it. And it's also finding those times to have meaningful conversations. I know I've got two teen boys, and finding time to talk to them and having real conversations is difficult. And some of the best conversations I've ever had with them is literally getting in the road and driving, and it's awesome. So we're seeing people wanting to reconnect, have that time, be in control, have the flexibility, and just get out on the open road.
Yeah, for sure. So it's all about making connections and those memories. Now, what are people saying about sharing their travel highlights on social media?
Well, that's so interesting. So what we're also finding is that people are living in the moment more. So over 80% of the people that we surveyed are more interested in just being in the moment. Yes, they're taking pictures, but they're actually waiting to post it on social media after they get back home, which is a nice trend. Again, a lot of us are buried in our phones and our computers all day, every day. So this idea that you can disconnect, hit the open road, find out what's around the bend. You're still taking pictures, but you're not glued to uploading at that moment. So it's really cool to see that people are waiting to share those memories after they're done with the trip.
Yeah, that's awesome. So what are some travel tips to make the drive more enjoyable?
Yeah. So we would recommend that while we're talking about spontaneity and flexibility, it's also great to plan a few intentional stops. So what we're looking at is the best thing you can do is travel and figure out where you plan to stop along the way. And a lot of folks are looking for convenience. So those one-stop shops. So where you can get in, you can fuel up, you can fill up with snacks, with drinks, and we can get you on your way. So travel centers are a great opportunity for that, and Pilot travel centers, or where you can do a one-stop shop. So it's a little bit different than a typical, you know, convenience store. You can get your gas, you can fill up. We have hot food, we have snacks, sweet and savory. You can grab jumbo wings, got a clean bathroom. We're open 24 hours a day. So it's really important that consumers find that they can get filled up and get on their way as fast as possible. And that's what travel centers are all about, the one-stop shop.
Yeah, for sure. Now, you mentioned budget. How can travelers save money when on the road?
Yeah, that's also a great question. As you know, with these pop-up, you know, escapes and being shorter time on the road, and we talked about it being $500 or less, another great way is to unlock savings. So downloading apps like the Pilot app, we're always running offers like 10 cents off gas. So you can either save on fuel. Sometimes we have bundle, we have food and snacks. So you can bundle that together with your fuel. So we're running deals all summer long. So look for downloading apps that are tools to help you travel, tools to help you save. And that's perfectly what Pilot Travel app does.
Okay, awesome. So where can people go for more information as they're planning their summer road trips?
Yeah, they can either visit us at pilotflyingj.com, or we have over 900 travel centers across the United States. So we would love for people to come visit us, and we would love to see you out here. So we're excited that we're seeing such a trend towards a lot of folks wanting just to hit the road this summer. And it's all about that space in between, and we want to be part of that journey. So we're looking forward to seeing everyone.
So pilotflyingj.com, that's just the letter J, the website for Pilot. And also take a look at what's nearby. Of course, being in Las Vegas, we have plenty of exciting things that you can get to within a day or within a weekend. So planning these short pop-up trips sounds like a great trend to me. We've been speaking today with Carrie Irons, VP of Brand Marketing at Pilot. And Carrie, I really appreciate you being here, letting us know where people's heads are at as far as summer travel goes and providing some tips to make it more enjoyable. So thank you so much for your time.
Definitely. Thank you for having me.
How about all text? You focus on the road.
As a passenger, you have the power to prevent an accident. There are 1,000 ways to stop a distracted driver. Choose one.
A message from CTIA.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Paul Rice, award-winning social entrepreneur, founder of Fairtrade USA, and author of Every Purchase Matters, How Fairtrade Farmers, Companies, and Consumers Are Changing the World. Paul, thank you so much for being here today.
Hi, Heather. It's great to be here.
So first of all, what is Fairtrade USA?
Fairtrade USA is a nonprofit organization that has the mission of alleviating poverty, improving lives, and protecting the environment. And we do that by developing standards for fair trade and auditing and certifying companies that meet that high standard for social and environmental compliance.
So how does a company become fair trade certified?
So the farms and factories that we work with around the world, about 1 million farms and factories today in 70 different countries, Africa, Asia, Latin America, mostly, some in the US as well, they apply to get certified. They work to meet the 200-point checklist of social, labor, and environmental criteria, and then they get audited annually. And when they pass that audit, then they are authorized to sell their products, coffee, bananas, fresh fruits and vegetables, and so on. They sell that with the Fairtrade certified label. And I'm guessing that our listeners have seen the Fairtrade certified label at the grocery store on coffee and other products. And so that means, number one, that the producers met a very high bar for sustainability. And then number two, that the retailer or the brand paid a little bit extra back to those farms or factories. And that extra money, which we call the impact premium, is controlled by the farmers and the workers themselves. And they invest that in healthcare programs, in education, in better housing, in clean water, in reforestation, in all kinds of great projects at the community level. So at the end of the day, Fairtrade Certified is a way for you and me as consumers to vote with our dollars and to improve the lives of people around the world through our everyday purchasing decisions.
Nice. Okay. So what are some of the major companies that are Fairtrade certified?
Oh gosh, we're working now with almost 2,000 companies, everyone from Whole Foods to Walmart, Costco, Kroger, Safeway, Trader Joe's, you name it. And at the brand level, we work with Patagonia and J. Crew in the apparel sector. We work with Williams-Sonoma, Pottery Barn, West Elm in furniture. We work with Elf Beauty in cosmetics. In coffee, we work with Nespresso. So in each product category, imagine the leading sustainability brands. those are the ones who have moved first with fair trade and started to build the movement. Today, as I said, 2,000 companies, I mean, literally every retailer in America now has at least some fair trade products on their shelves.
So it's obviously a benefit to the suppliers, but why is it important for consumers to consider fair trade certified products?
You know, consumers are looking increasingly for high quality products that are safe and healthy and that don't destroy the environment or exploit workers. There's, you know, a growing body of literature around the psychology of consumer behavior, especially Gen Z and millennial consumers index really high in terms of their expectations of companies' behavior. And so more and more consumers are looking for great products that also have great impact. And fair trade and other forms of ethical sourcing really speak very directly to that impact.
Yeah, for sure. So how did you originally come to be involved in the conscious capitalism movement?
You know, I was always passionate about social justice and sustainability. And so fresh out of college, I went to Nicaragua to work with farmers. And I stayed there for 11 years, way up in the mountains, working with coffee farmers. I ended up starting Nicaragua's first fair trade co-op. And I grew that over 4 years into a movement of 3,000 small family farmers across northern Nicaragua. We were selling coffee on fair trade terms to buyers in Europe who were paying us $1 a pound for our coffee at a time when the local middlemen in Nicaragua were paying 10 cents per pound. So literally 10 times more money landing in the pockets of our farmers. And what that meant was that they could stay home, they could stay on the land instead of having to immigrate to flee poverty. They were keeping their kids in school. They were setting up scholarship programs to send their kids on to high school and college. We ran healthcare programs. We dug wells and brought clean drinking water into our villages for the first time. We taught farmers organic and sustainable agricultural practices. We did all of this amazing work in both social and environmental terms, and none of it was thanks to any government program or international charity. It was all simply thanks to this very simple idea of a fair price for a great product. And I led that co-op for 4 years, and that experience really kind of changed my worldview and my perspective on capitalism and made me realize that business can be a force for good. And that's what led me to move back to the U.S. in 94 and launch Fairtrade USA. Fairtrade at the time was big in Europe, and there was not much going on in the U.S. at the time. And so my calling was to see if I could bring the movement here to the U.S. and engage American consumers and companies and see if we could build a fair trade movement here.
And you did.
Well, we're still growing, you know. I mean, in the big picture, I would say fair trade is still small, but it's growing very fast. I just saw some numbers. The produce industry, so fresh fruits and vegetables sales last year in the United States grew by 2%. Fair trade produce grew by 25%. So it gives you a sense of that, going back to your question about what do consumers get out of it. I mean, clearly consumers are choosing fair trade products, and they're choosing it, I believe, because fair trade products are high quality products that improve lives and help protect the environment.
Yeah, that's awesome. So how are tariffs affecting fair trade?
In no different way than it's affecting everyone else. I mean, tariffs, I haven't met anyone who supports tariffs yet. And I talk to a lot of business people. I talk to a lot of consumer advocacy groups. Tariffs are going to raise consumer prices. They're inherently inflationary, which is bad for America coming out of a period of a few years of inflation. Tariffs are going to hurt the businesses that we work with. It's going to be a setback for sustainability. So in general, you know, I see tariffs as not good for either the consumer or the business community. And fair trade is going to get impacted exactly the same way.
Yeah. Okay. What inspired you to write your new book, Every Purchase Matters, How Fair Trade Farmers, Companies, and Consumers Are Changing the World?
You know, for a long time, I had imposter syndrome. I didn't think that I had a right to write a book about the journey. And I don't know, about 20 years in, I started to feel like, okay, we've made enough progress with fair trade, and we've also made plenty of mistakes and learned a lot from both. And so well, I should tell the story. And so it took me a few years to write the book, but the book just came out 6 weeks ago, and it's a national bestseller. And, you know, my goal was to support both everyday consumers in their understanding of sustainability and fair trade and responsible sourcing. I think so many consumers are hungry to know what's behind the label and do, you know, products with labels on them really have an impact. I think there's some skepticism out there. So I wanted to kind of peel back the curtain and give consumers a sense of how all these things work. I also wanted to write a book that would kind of light the path, if you will, for business people who are trying to bring sustainability into their businesses, who are trying to bring ethical sourcing and things like fair trade into their businesses. And so the book is a book of stories. I interviewed over 40 CEOs and activists and farmers and workers, and I really bring to life the fair trade movement and the lessons learned over the last 26 years through the voices of amazing individuals like Doug McMillon, the CEO of Walmart, and John Mackey, the founder of Whole Foods, and people like that. And, you know, it's my hope that this book will both encourage business people to do more in sustainability and help everyday consumers realize that indeed every purchase matters. And we have the ability as individuals to make small but meaningful change in the world and to have an impact on farming families that, you know, live a half a world away growing our coffee and our bananas and our tea and other products, and who just need a little bit more for their products in order to lead a dignified life.
That's great. So it sounds like a lot of amazing information in the book, but what are some of the biggest insights and takeaways that you hope people will get from reading the book?
Well, first of all, certification matters. Companies that talk about sustainability but don't really open their books to auditing and certification are often not performing at the same level as those companies that really go for transparency. And so I think, you know, whether it's organic certification or non-GMO or fair trade or Rainforest Alliance, any of the certifiers that are in this space, I think are bringing an added level of credibility to product claims around sustainability. So that's one key message. Another message is what I referred to a minute ago around, you know, consumer choice really making a difference. We've seen the impact. Last year alone, Fairtrade USA and its partners generated over $100 million in impact premiums, which went back to the farms and the workers around the world in which they were able to invest in incredible projects that had a truly transformative impact in the lives of so many people. And so, you know, bottom line is sustainability works and it is making a difference. And the other thing I would say, you know, from this book is another key takeaway is that there has to be a business case for sustainability to be scalable, right? It's not enough just to ask companies to do more and to do better by the planet and the people. There needs to be a value proposition for companies. Otherwise, it's not going to scale. And so, at Fair Trade, we've spent many years trying to find that win-win scenario where the companies that are practicing fair trade win and the consumer and the farmer and the worker all win as well. And so, you know, for example, Elf Beauty, one of the new companies that we're working with, the second largest beauty brand in the United States, and they jumped into fair trade a few years ago. They're now up to 80-85% fair trade across all their products. And one of the things they found was when they put the fair trade label on their products, it helped distinguish their brand from other beauty companies and it helped build sales. And so there's a very direct relationship between sustainability and what they're doing for the workers in their factories on the one hand, and then the loyalty of consumers to their brand and the willingness to buy the product. And so that for me is like a great example of the win-win there, where companies are generating impact for the world, but they're also benefiting as companies too. And I think that enlightened self-interest is what's going to drive the future growth of the fair trade movement.
Yeah, that's fantastic. All right, so where can people find out more about fair trade or get a copy of your new book, Every Purchase Matters, How Fair Trade Farmers, Companies, and Consumers Are Changing the World?
You can get a copy of the book, Every Purchase Matters, wherever you buy books. It's on Barnes & Noble. It's on Amazon. It's in your local bookstores. For more information, you can check out my website, paulrice.org, or Fairtrade USA's website, fairtradeusa.org.
All right. Fantastic. So once again, Paul's website is paulrice.org. paulrice.org. You can find out more about what he does. If you'd like to pick up a copy of his book, Every Purchase Matters, it's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or wherever you buy your books. And if you'd like to find out more about fair trade and fair trade certification, check out the Fair Trade USA website, fairtradeusa.org. And we've been speaking today with Paul Rice, award-winning social entrepreneur, founder of Fairtrade USA, and author of Every Purchase Matters, How Fair Trade Farmers, Companies, and Consumers Are Changing the World. And Paul, I really appreciate you sharing your story of how you have helped to change the world for the better and influenced so many people along the way, so many companies, so many consumers, so many farmers. So thank you so much for sharing today.
Oh, thank you, Heather. I really appreciate your thoughtful questions and for helping me get the word out.
In 1945, the original care package inspired people around the world. Today, we're reaching 170 million people in over 110 countries. Because when history repeats itself, so does care. Join at care.org.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include this Monday, June 9th at 8 p.m., benefiting Down Syndrome Connections, and Monday, June 23rd at 8 p.m., benefiting the 3630 Foundation. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. And the Las Vegas Rescue Mission is holding their annual bottled water drive through August 31st. When the summer is hot, vulnerable community members experiencing homelessness need water more than ever. You can drop off bottled water donations at the Las Vegas Rescue Mission security gate 24/7. Find out more at vegasrescue.org. That's vegasrescue.org.